The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and this program comes to you from the Commonwealth Institute. And those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Phyllis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden. Round one tries to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words approximately right. Beginning with Anne Scott-James. Anne, what's the meaning of exotic?
Oh, this is often slightly wrongly used as to mean glamorous. It really means foreign.
Yes, I think that's good enough.
From abroad.
2 marks. Foreign, coming from a foreign country, not belonging to the country in question. So if you talk about an exotic blonde, you oughtn't probably to do so, unless you are actually in Mecca or somewhere like that at the moment, where exotic blondes are not very common. Frank Miller, this is quite different again. What is a chitak? C-H-I-T-T-A-C-K. C-H-I-T-T-A-C-K. Chitak.
Chitak. I think when one civil servant dislikes another, he doesn't punch him, which is uncivil service-like behaviour. He sends him a memo with four-letter words on it. And this attack, as it were, by chit, is called a chitack. Apart from that, it sounds Indian.
Yes, Indian is quite right.
Chittagong. And,
It's an Indian weight. Roughly corresponding with an ounce. Nigelus Power, what is a jobbernowl? J-O-B-B-E-R-N-O-W-L. Jobbernowl.
Jobbernowl?
Mm.
It's like, it's the scout's term. It's like bobber job. You get paid for every hole you dig. It's a jobbernowl.
It's a jobbernowl. It's a kind of, it's what I feel like.
Well, I hope
when
you
I can't
Dennis,
answer the question.
Might. Yes, that's very close indeed.
It's a dumb, white-haired lady.
I'll give you one and a half marks.
It's a jolly, silly woman.
I can't give you two, because there's nothing about white-haired in this at all. It means a stupid head or a stupid, silly person.
Exactly what I said.
From an old word from the French meaning fool and knoll meaning head. So the head's all right, but not the white. 1.5. Dennis Norden, what is a wheatear? W-H-E-A-T-E-A-R, one word. Wheatear.
Wheatear. Wheatear sounds like the maximum amount of emotion an unsentimental Scotsman would permit himself. Just a wheatear. but if it's W-H, you said it's W-H-E-A-T-E-A-R,
yes.
A wheat ear, could I make a tremendous intellectual leap and suggest it's an ear of wheat?
That's why I kept it as one word, because I think it would be two words if it were what you've just suggested.
Oh.
It is one word.
Well, then it's something that looks like an wheat.
No,
looks
not
like
quite.
An ear of wheat.
It's a bird,
actually. Yes, all right. It's the stonechat, or white tail, and I have to go very carefully here. It was originally not wheat ear, but wheat ears, and if you think that out very carefully indeed, it means a bird with a white behind.
Ah.
1 out of 2. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the two women members of each team to study them, and at the end of the program, I shall ask them for the source of these two quotations. So, beginning with Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is next of kin, and Dennis Powell and Frank, yours is the last of the Mohicans. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written or otherwise dealt with. And then round two itself, which is about legend and mythology. 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott-James, who was Aeolus? A-E-O-L-U-S. Aeolus.
Oh, he was the wind god, and he kept the winds in a bag.
Yeah.
Whenever he let them out, there was a storm, and he lived in the Straits of Messina.
Oh, well done. Yes, yes, yes. That's terribly good and accurate. He was a favorite of the gods on Olympus, and Zeus appointed him the ruler or keeper of the winds, and as Anne quite rightly says, from his island in the far west, which is completely surrounded by a brazen wall, he was visited by Odysseus and gave him winds that he could use on his voyage, and all the nasty winds were put up in a leather bag, and some very unpleasant character unloosed that, and it wasn't very nice for Odysseus. 2 marks it is. Frank Muir, who was Hebe? H-E-B-E, Hebe.
Was what Hebe was different from what Hebe now? Said he, covering time while he reads what Dillis has written. Yes, the cupbearer.
Yes?
Hebe, the bearer of the cup. Send for Hebe.
Of course.
Yes, the cupbearer to the gods.
That was her job.
A maiden it was, a lady.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's her job, but what was she the goddess of?
Mirth and laughter and cheerfulness and gaiety and let's go on a bit. How many words can we have?
The goddess of jocularity and...
well, drink, wit. Drink anyway.
1.5. 2. as Dillis Powell quite rightly says, she was the handmaiden of the gods and she poured out nectar in cups for them, but she was the Greek goddess of youth, the goddess of rejuvenation, and hence when she moved over to Rome among the Romans, she was called Juventus, which meant youth. 1.5. Dillis Powell, who was so strong that even as a newborn babe in his cot, he strangled 2 serpents who tried to kill him?
Heracles.
And do you remember why they were there?
Well, his mother,
yeah,
was determined to protect him. And so she had him brought up among a lot of girls. And somebody, I think Odysseus, in order... Was it Odysseus? I can't remember. Somebody, anyhow, not Odysseus. Somebody who suspected that he was really a tough young gentleman put the snakes there to see what would happen.
I think I'm going to give you your 2 marks. You've mixed up 2 legends, but you've done it so delightfully that I don't mind. Heracles, or Hercules, was the son of Zeus, not by his proper wife, but by a girl called Alcmene, and his real wife, Hera, was so jealous that she sent these 2 serpents to finish Heracles off. But later, it's quite true, Heracles had to live among the women as a penance. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, who was Hymen, or as you and I know better, Hymen? And I emphasize who.
Yes. Do you want to know about what? he was Greek.
Yeah.
He was the god of... wasn't love. Hymenio. It was marriage.
Yes.
Got to do with marriage, as in Hymen, the mood for love.
Two marks, Dennis, that's all right. He's the Greek god of marriage and of the marriage song, because in origin, according to one legend, he fell in love with a girl, and because he wanted to be with her, disguised himself as a woman in order to go with her on an all-woman sort of band or pilgrimage to a place called Eleusis, and then saved them later after they were all attacked by pirates. And then he married the girl, and everything went well, and this Hymeneal song was sung on the procession of the bride from her parents' house to that of the bridegroom. The next round's about slang expressions, and they came into use mainly during one of the 2 of the last great wars. And I want to know what they mean. 2 marks, you'll get them right. Beginning with Anne Scott James, sky pilot.
Sky what?
Sky pilot.
Sky pilot.
P-I-L-O-T.
Oh, yes, padres.
That'll do. 2 marks. A clergyman, especially among naval types and people like that. Frank Muir, to work one's ticket.
Well, that was to pretend that one... one was unfit for military service and therefore be discharged.
2 marks it is.
And all about that.
Have yourself discharged from the forces by getting yourself judged medically unfit, frequently not quite justifiably. 2 marks. Lewis Powell, it's all teed up. T-double-E-apostrophe-D. It's all teed up.
It means it's all prepared and ready.
Comes from?
Golf, I should have thought.
I think it's a rather easy one. 2 marks it is. It's all arranged, it's all organised, all laid on, and it comes from that least difficult, or supposedly least difficult shot at golf, where you have, in fact, arranged the ball very carefully on a tee before you hit it. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, all wool and a yard wide.
This wasn't any of the wars I was in. It's either something that's absolutely marvellous or absolutely terrible.
Something to do with a uniform.
Is it? Wool. It's all wool and a yard wide, said the sergeant ringingly.
Yes, just so.
Yeah. And meaning?
I don't know. I never did understand what they said half the time. I've never heard it, Jack. I've never heard it.
Would this suggest something good or something bad, Dennis?
It's all wool. It depends the tone you say it in. What?
That's
all wool and a yard wide, that is. Or you could say, by golly, he's all wool and a yard wide.
Well, that's it. Dennis, this is what I want. But are you expressing approbation or the reverse?
Approbation.
All right, one out of two. That helped a bit. It means utterly sound and honest, anybody you meet who is that. And it comes from terms of drapery, meaning the very highest quality and a jolly good bargain at the price, too. Well, now we come to a more or less appetizing round of foreign foods. 2 marks, if you can tell me what you would expect to be served with if you picked up a menu and asked the waiter, assuming he wasn't entirely stupid, for the following. Anne Scott James, kebab, K-E-B-A-B.
I should expect some delicious little pieces of lamb, probably lamb, which would have been sprinkled with salt and with delicious oriental herbs and speared on a skewer and grilled on a charcoal grill.
But were the little bits of lamb entirely adjacent to each other?
Well, I've eaten a lot of kebabs, and in the sort of rather common or garden places, yes, they certainly would be. But with any luck, you'd have little mushrooms stuck, bay leaves stuck between.
Thank you very much, Anne. That's exactly...
I'll send the recipe to anybody who wants it.
Exactly what I wanted, Anne. Pieces of lamb and various vegetables, sometimes other meats as well, threaded on a skewer and then roasted, and it's a Turkish dish by origin, though it's very like the Greek souvlaki. Frank Muir... Pamplemousse
is a harfa thing you get in France, yellow citrus fruit, with a preserved cherry in the middle, which you throw away. It is in fact a grapefruit.
Pamplemousse is the French for grapefruit. 2 marks, well done. The Delispar, moussaka.
I should expect something which was baked in a dish, which had some meat at the bottom. And then a layer of probably aubergine,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps a bit of potato,
yeah.
and perhaps a bit of this, that, and the other.
No meat.
And a bit of cheese.
Mm, jolly good. You're getting
it absolutely,
absolutely
delicious.
It's a Balkan version of what we call shepherd's pie, but with aubergine, and it's Greek. Dennis Norden, goulash.
Well, that's Hungarian, and it's a sort of stew. It has paprika in it.
Yes.
And the more you eat, the less you sleep, is my experience.
I think that'll do. Yeah. A savory stew of beef and vegetables, well seasoned with paprika, and it is Hungarian. And originally, it means herdsman's meat.
Herdsman's pie.
Well, herdsman's pie.
So shepherd's pie.
It's also a term from contract bridge, but I'm not very good at that game, so I won't go on with that. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation in its particular context, Next of Kin?
All I can remember is going to a film in the war called Next of
That's
Kin.
That's right. It was a wartime film on careless talk and espionage where the plans of a raid on the far coasts, as it might be at Dieppe. They were inadvertently passed over to the enemy and everything went wrong. Tourist Powell, the origin of your quotation, and this was The Last of the Mohicans.
It's the title of a novel by Fenimore Cooper.
Jolly good. Well, now I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back, first of all, to Dennis Norden and his phrase, next of kin.
I would entreat, nay, plead, with anybody in a moving car never to throw a lighted cigarette end out of the window. I say this because some time ago I was walking along the Bayswater Road in London on the Hyde Park side, and I knelt down to tie up my shoelace facing the railings. And I felt this searing heat behind me, as though I'd been fired on by a tracer bullet, and I shot forward. Now, you may think, as I thought, that by the simple laws of nature, if your head enters between two railings, it would naturally withdraw just as easily. But it was not so. I found I was stuck in this crouching position, my head stuck in the railings on the unfashionable side of the Bayswater Road. And I tried to attract the attention of passers-by, but you don't get them on that side of the road at all. In fact, only one person passed, a lady, in a sort of rabbit coat, smoking a cigarette. And she looked at me, wriggling and pulling back between these two bars of iron which prisoned my neck. And she said, "Hello, cheeky." And I ignored her and pretended I was just sort of an ordinary commoner garden peeping Tom or something. And continued with my struggle. It was now about 1:30 in the morning, so I stretched my arms wide and grasped about 5 railings further on either side and pulled upwards and felt something giving. That whole segment of railing came away and I was able to stand, but with the railing round my neck, about the size and the shape of a window frame. I thought, how am I going to get home? Because it would be very difficult to get on a bus. Because upstairs, I only like travelling upstairs because I smoke. And you couldn't get through that narrow bit. And I was walking down the Bayswater Road in this kind of giant collar. And I suddenly noticed a police car coming. I thought, hello. So I saw at the side of the road, there was a hole in the road where workmen had been digging. And I jumped down this hole. And the railing sort of spanned the hole, and my neck stuck out, my head and neck stuck out on top, and I just sort of closed my eyes and hoped for the best, and this police car passed. And as I stuck in this hole, thinking, now, what is my next move? And a very elderly night watchman came out, and he said, "Hello, a football." I said, "Stop," just as he got his leg back. And I said, "Can you help me?" He said, "Hello." He said, "You just come up from the sewers?" I said, "No, I'm stuck. This is a railing." "Oh, dear," he said. "Well," he said, "I'll ring an ambulance." He said, I'll ring Bart's." And sure enough, I went down there and had to this awful ordeal in the waiting room for an hour among all the drug addicts, you know, and the people who had been beaten by their husbands and so on, trying to look rather nonchalant as if I'd come for an ingrowing toenail. But they were very good at the hospital, and they've got this oxyacetylene lamp. And when I woke up, I was on this hospital bed with this marvellous feeling of freedom round my neck. A feeling that's only known to people who've worn a railing for 2 or 3 hours. And I thought, I must thank the nurse, and I stretched back. to ring the bell. I don't know if you know hospital beds. Yes, they've got these bars. Which is why this phrase that was quoted always has a particularly poignant ring for me. Neck stuck in.
I was always taught, Dennis, you carried a quarter of a pound of butter in your pocket and you smeared it all over your ears and then you got out. Perhaps it doesn't work. Well, back to Frank Muir with his quotation, which, if you remember, was "The Last of the Mohicans."
Funny, Dennis, telling that story, because it rather reminded me of my last brush with the medical profession. A few days ago, I was sitting in my club in the morning room reading The Lancet. There's an article by Dr. Jonathan Miller, and I read The Last of the Mohicans by Dr. Jonathan Miller, and I was crying quietly to myself. I wasn't sad or anything, don't think that for one moment, but I just had lunch, and I'd had goulash for lunch, which has paprika in it, you know, which is red pepper, and some of the paprika had lodged around one tonsil and was sending out little shock waves of heat, rather like a miniature blast furnace, and I was coughed and cried, and the tears were streaming down, and I was trying to read this article in The Lancet by Dr. Jonathan Miller called The Last of the Mohicans. And the name Jonathan Miller suddenly rang a bell. I do a television panel game, and also on the program, a little while back, was this man who'd written this article, this Jonathan Miller. And he was on this program, and he looked at me and said, "You've got a really rather interesting condition of Raynaud's disease. Would you mind very much if I came along and I examined you?" I got a bit worried about this. I mean, he's a pathologist, you know. But I went along anyway, and he said, "Well, Raynaud's disease is actually, when you're very cold, the blood circulation affects your hands and your fingers go sort of dead, which mine do, they've always done. They go right dead back to the hands." And he said, "The colder it is, the deader they go." I said, "Do you mean if it sort of meets in the middle, I'll die?" He said, no. "It's nothing like that, but he said, if I could give you a thorough examination, could you come back on Thursday and measure yourself and weigh yourself?" So I thought, well, I better, you know, go into this. So I went away, and I weighed myself, and knowing doctors, I weighed myself with nothing on. You know, and I was 13 stone 2. I only just had time to read it because there were rather a lot of people in the chemist shop at the time. Then I went along to his rather nice little room, and he said, "Well, what I'm interested in," he said, is that, "does this only happen in your fingers, or does it happen in your other extremity?" I said, "My head." He said, no, "your feet, for instance. We must try." Because the weather was still cold, so he backed a table against the window, opened the window, took off my shoes and socks, and slid my legs out of the window, and then closed the window down on them. My feet got very cold. The whole thing was rather unpleasant, and a small boy chalked a rude word on my left side. And then he brought my feet back in again, and they'd gone white and colourless too, right back to the ankle bone. And he got terribly excited about this, because I don't know about you, but I've got corns. But he got frantically excited at these. He said, "When Raynaud's disease, don't you see, they're shining." He said, "This is the most interesting thing, that your corns are shining. They have a sort of lustrous, opalescent look to them." He said, "May I a moment and photograph my poor feet and the corns?" And he got the light so that the shine reflected off the corns. And presumably, he wrote his article. Because suddenly, sitting in the club, reading this, The Last of the Mohicans, by Jonathan Miller in The Lancet, I suddenly realized that this was the story of my shiny little calluses on my feet. And I knuckled the goulash tears out of my eyes until I could focus more carefully and found it wasn't The Last of the Americans at all. You know what the title of the article was? The Luster of the Muircons.
What Frank was really suffering from was third-degree frostbite, from which there's absolutely no cure at all. And we reach a very remarkable result with a very remarkable audience, because there is an absolute draw between Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. You've given exactly the same amount of applause to each of them, and that leads us to a final score in which Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win by 2 marks from Dennis and from Anne Scott James. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. Thank you.